You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, obviously, the big news of the past week since we recorded the last show is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So, which, of course, is terrible, and obviously, our sympathies are with Ukraine and the Ukrainian people. We were hoping to actually have our friend George Traub on the show today, who is Ukrainian. He obviously has a lot of strong emotions and opinions and information about what's going on, but unfortunately, he was not available tonight as we're recording. Maybe we'll get him on, you know, I doubt this is going to go away anytime soon. So we'll probably have him on at some point, you know, during the situation. It's been weird. It's been a weird week. Yeah. You know,
it's been horrifying.
That's the thing. It's horrifying on the one side, although we saw it coming, you know, we knew what Putin was going to do. But at the other side, it's like, yeah, it's Ukraine and Zelensky have been inspiring.
Oh, for sure.
Talk about like Zelensky kicked Putin's ass in terms of the PR battle. Totally. Like Putin is humiliated. I think it's fair to say in terms of he's an international pariah. We totally call this bluff on the sanctions, and they're not even militarily executing their assault well. They're getting, they're getting bogged down already.
Yeah.
So they failed like on every level, and so it's horrible, but it's also a little inspiring, the reaction to it, you know?
Yeah, I think the thing that's so sad to see, A, obviously, is the death and destruction of this, you know, incredibly illegal invasion, and also the reporting even out of Russia, how many of Russian citizens are bewildered and depressed by what's going on? Because they're not obviously backing Putin. Sure, some Russians probably are, but a large percentage of Russian citizens are like, why is my country doing this?
Right, because they are the ones who are most affected as far as people on the Russian side of this goes. The day-to-day people, you know, Putin and his oligarchs and all the people high up, and they'll be fine in a certain sense, but it's the people who are going to pay. Do you know the ruble today is worth less than 1 cent to compare to the US dollar?
Yeah.
That ruble has absolutely crashed near zero. I mean, and how is that not going to impact your average Russian citizen?
Wow.
They are the ones ultimately, I mean, there's obviously loss of life, but they are very much paying the price now and very far into the future for this.
Well, Ev, this is clearly a sign of, you know, a government doing what the government wants to do and the people have nothing to do with it. You know, I mean, I'm not judging the Russian people at all on any of this. I feel bad for them that they're stuck in this horrible situation. I agree with you, Kara. I mean, the number one thing here that's keeping me awake at night is definitely like, you know, the people of Ukraine and what, you know, could you just imagine having to go through any of that?
Ugh.
But my God, is their leadership so awesome? Like, it is so inspiring to see the global response and to see Ukraine leadership stand up in the absolute face of what I consider to be certain death.
Right.
Yeah.
Say like, I'm not leaving Kyiv. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stand here for my people, with my people. And I'm not going to let you make these, like, what? He literally called Ukrainian, I guess Putin was referring to the government when he said that it was like the Nazification of Ukraine by a Jewish Holocaust, like descendant of Holocaust survivor. Like, this is who, what is he doing?
Yeah. This isn't coming out of nowhere. This is, you know, the part of the narrative that Putin is promoting, but it goes back
propaganda.
To Stalin. It goes back to Stalin. This is not new at all. So even, you know, in the early days of the 20th century, you know, essentially Russia's had its eyes on Ukraine for a very long time. It wants to absorb Ukraine and make it its own. And that's why there is this denial of the legitimacy of like an independent Ukraine. You know, even back, you know, in Stalin's days, there was a program of the Russification of Ukraine. You know, they would essentially, you know, replace, you know, all the people in power and the intellectuals and everybody with Russians and ban speaking Ukrainian in schools and, you know, trying to make like Russian the official language. And of course, it didn't work, but that, you know, it worked for a while under the Soviet Union, but it, you know, not past that. So this is a continuation of that. And when Putin says things like, you know, Ukraine is like part of our culture and our history, and it's not really an independent, legitimate, you know, country of its own, that's what he's referring to, that this is what that Russia was trying to make it not a legitimate country. So yeah, this isn't there's a lot of a pretty deep historical context there. It kind of makes that what looks like an unhinged rant at least puts it into context. It's like, yeah, he's not coming up with this stuff on the fly. This is a long-standing program.
He's former KGB. We can't forget that.
But it's so dark.
Yeah, it's very dark.
It's very dark. You know what I mean? It's like, as practiced as it is and as much as the sort of rhetoric has been building, I don't think that he has been as, I don't know, effective.
Oh, he underestimated the whole thing, I think. I think he miscalculated this terribly.
Like, it's like he didn't do his due diligence to, like, get the buy-in first. You know what I mean?
How much does he care? How much does he even care about all that?
Well, but it seemed
what's
like
gonna happen
cost
to him
a lot of money if he cares about that.
I can't interpret this any other way than them thinking that they were going to get this job done in a couple of days. Like, you know, no sweat, no mess.
Yeah, it was
clearly that was the plan. I've read a lot of military analysis of what's going on, and they all start with military experts are baffled, you know, by Russia's tactics here, because it sounds like they were just going to sweep in, expect no resistance, take over Kyiv in 48 hours, replace the government, and it's done. Right, that was their plan, and they were completely, you know, shocked by the resistance that they met, and now the Ukrainian military and the, you know, civilian militias have had a chance to dig in, erect defenses, and get needed supplies. And it's going to be a protracted
EU,
war.
Yeah, everybody's backing them.
Yeah. So now the question is,
in what way, like, though?
How
financially and with weapons?
With weapons. How desperate is Putin going to get? Because he's not going to just lay down and take a loss here. Now the next step is to do what he's done, like in Georgia and Syria. Is he going to start carpet bombing cities? I mean,
The thing. I feel like, isn't there already some evidence pointing to the fact that he's like committing war crimes?
Yes,
like,
I
think so.
There are accusations of him using weapons that are banned and not supposed to be used, especially against civilians and targeting civilians. But it's, you know, it's fog of war and all that. It's hard to say.
But ultimately, let's say that he does have to back down. Let's say that, like, you know, this is a failed military operation. What's the outcome of that? Is there a way for Putin to face charges? Is there a way for Putin to be, I don't know. If he is found to commit war crimes.
An international court could find him, couldn't they?
Again, we're not experts on this, guys. We're not politicians and everything. We're trying to digest what we're reading in the news. My understanding is that Russia's not part of the international court system, so he's outside of it. And so it's questionable, from what I've read, whether or not he could be held accountable by any international court.
Or if he would even go, if he'd be like, can't make
it. Of course he wouldn't. No.
Exactly.
Ignore it, obviously. But, I mean, forget him traveling anywhere outside of Russia now.
Strategically, he lost already. I mean, the fact that Germany completely reversed their post-Cold War policy. And they're like, okay, we're going to double our military spending and we're going to give weapons to Ukraine. You know, like essentially Putin has accomplished for the U.S. in days what we have been unable to accomplish in years.
Oh my God, Steve.
Totally backfired on
him. Can you say that again? that felt so good. I mean,
and not just for the U.S., but for Europe.
For NATO. NATO. U.S.'s goals for NATO. Like NATO, again, I think Putin was clearly counting on NATO collapsing, and instead he has unified NATO. NATO is now stronger, more unified, more determined, and it's showing in very concrete policy, such as, you know, Germany's reversal. So he's got to be feeling the hurt, you know, in terms of that. But again, it's what are we on, day 6 or 7? It's still early days. A lot is going to determine on how long NATO and the West can sustain what we're doing. It's going to be, so we're sort of, we call this bluff, we're sort of winning the game of chicken so far, and now it's a matter of who's going to have the endurance. Are we going to be able to bite the bullet You know, like when people start paying more at the pump, how much are they going to be like, okay, I'll do that for NATO and Ukraine and to stick it to Putin? Or are they going to be like, this is crazy. I can't pay 20 cents more for a gallon of gas. Who's responsible for this? We have to end this right now. So it depends on how, you know, again, I'm very emboldened by how the world has reacted so far. And now we have to sustain it. You know, that's going to be
never
the big test.
Easy.
Never easy. Mm-hmm. We have to have more endurance than Putin and the Russians do in this, or he will be proven correct in the long term. You know, if we eventually tire of these the downside of the sanctions for us, you know, and Europe's going to feel it more than America is. Gas is still like, you know, pretty cheap in the United States compared to the world,
with other countries.
Compared to historically, I mean, you know, we are so spoiled in terms of the cost of our gas. And Europe pays a lot more than we do, and they are way more dependent on Russian fossil fuel.
We did just, along though with a lot of other countries, open up a lot of our reserves, right?
Yeah, but that's very temporary. That's like, from what I read, it's like, that was 12 hours worth of gasoline. You're like,
really?
Was.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's like days. It's insignificant compared to, because we consume so much. Yeah,
which is like helpful if this thing, you know, if this thing doesn't
That
go
was
on
symbolic.
On, but.
Yeah, releasing a little bit from the strategic reserves was more symbolic than anything.
I see.
You know, but long term, but here's the thing, you know, again, I'm reading early reports that Germany's like, maybe we can't close down all of our nuclear power plants. Maybe we should reopen a couple of the ones that we shut down. If they're not getting natural gas through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia, they have no choice. You know, they may have to just keep nuclear going for 20 years until they really build out, you know, their renewable infrastructure enough that they
including new nuclear
independent of Russian gas. You know, that's just the way it is. So again, if they can. Hopefully, we can turn this into a greater push for oil independence, meaning burning less fossil fuel. You know, that would be a good outcome.
Oh, it's so sad, though, that is such a fundamental part of this very basic human conflict, is these financial incentives, these economic incentives. Like, and I'm glad that this is, you know, the diplomacy, I guess, that we're utilizing, because I actually think in the long run, it reduces the cost on human life.
Yeah.
But it's so sad when I really think about war and the costs of war and what are we accomplishing here?
So I think one of the more bizarre aspects of this whole thing was the head of Roscosmos essentially threatening to crash the ISS in retaliation to American and European sanctions.
Like onto the U.S., like crash it onto the U.S.
Yeah, so it's not going to hit us. It's going to hit either U.S. or Europe. Maybe it'll hit China. How's that going to work out for you?
Smacks of desperation.
Rogozin. Yeah. NASA responded just by saying, everything's fine. You know, we continue to work normally with all of our partners, including Russia, on the ISS. They basically just completely downplayed it. Essentially calling his bluff on it,
right,
I guess.
Another bluff call. Mm-hmm.
But also, like, the ISS is in no immediate danger of deorbiting, you know, without you know, Russian engines correcting its orbit. It would take at least a couple of years. And, you know, we have the ability to get up there with our own craft. So we would figure something out in the meantime if Russia did decide to pull out of the ISS abruptly.
And, of course, Roscosmos is, you know, pulling all of their personnel and halting all of their operations, both in Kazakhstan at Baikonur and also, I think right now, in French Guiana, the two places where Ariane Space launches Soyuz. But do we need Soyuz? Like, it's helpful. Is it the only way?
Not anymore, because we have the Dragon crew. Yeah.
Yeah. So got
SpaceX.
We've got American rockets and American launch sites. So we're not, it's not like, you know, it may delay the Galileo satellites that were scheduled to launch there in April, you know, because that's right around the corner. But I don't think in the long term, cutting off that utilization would really affect.
Yeah,
I don't know. It seems like a weird diplomatic move.
It is sad, too, because the ISS was a symbol of international cooperation, which stood above politics and above
sort
of thing. Dragging the ISS immediately into this conflict was a low blow.
I know. Can you imagine being a cosmonaut on the ISS right now?
Yeah, there's two of them up there.
Yeah, and they're like, I didn't say that. That was the dude
that was my
back
boss.
Home. Yeah. Right. Well, like we don't buy into this.
Well, I mean, don't the cosmonaut
looks on the space station?
Yeah, like ancient look at each other.
Oof.
We talk about taking your ball off the playing field. Like, well, we're gonna crash the space station on you.
Screw you guys. Really? I'm going home.
I know, but think about that. That has nothing has ever been uttered like that before. Like, it's just insane. Yeah.
Well, it's very Cold War, isn't it? It's very it's such a game of chicken.
All right. Well, this is obviously a rapidly evolving story. The thing is, by the time this show airs, it's going to be a very different situation. Yeah. Remember, we're recording this on Tuesday. We say it at the top of the show. Some people forget. Like, we got emailed last week about, hey, why didn't you talk about Ukraine? Because that happened after we recorded the show. You know, just remember to listen to the date we record at the top, and stuff happens, you know, during the post-production time. But we'll probably mention this in the future. Again, I'm sure we'll have George on at some point to talk about it as well, give his perspective since he is Ukrainian.
And it's a good reminder to tune into us live on Fridays, 5 o'clock Eastern time for our shows, because we did speak about it then.
We did. We did speak about it on a Friday. Absolutely.
Yes. Join us on Fridays.
All right. Let's get to some news items. Bob, you're going to start with this quantum gravity meteor thing.
Gradiometer. Yes. So researchers claim that the end of an international race to be the first to use quantum mechanics to peer into the ground using a quantum gravity gradiometer, which employs an even more revolutionary atomic interferometer. So Dr. Michael Hoylinski is the head of the Atom Interferometry at Birmingham University and the lead author on the study that was published in Nature. And in it, he describes the ability of this device to detect a tunnel 3 feet underground using basically just gravity. So I am reminded of the end of one of the greatest superhero movies of all time, The Incredibles. Remember at the very end when the Underminer and his drilling machine
emerged from the ground
and he announces to the world, I am always beneath you, but nothing is beneath me. Do you remember that? Probably the best line ever contemplated for a subterranean villain bent on destruction. I mean, how perfect is it? So, but it got me thinking, how do we know what's beneath us? You know, this is critical. You know, if you want to build something huge and important, like you got public works, some highway, roads, buildings, like, hey, how about the Leaning Tower of Pisa? More often than desired, there's something down there, like sinkholes, mine shafts, maybe even an underminer.
Hire a dowser to find it
right.
for you.
And how many times have you cursed the road projects that go on forever near your home or near work and go way over budget? Many times it's because someone said, whoa, I didn't know that was down there. And that just throws a monkey wrench in the whole works, right? And that's one of the reasons why the expenses go crazy and it takes years and years for some of this stuff to finish because of the unexpected things that they come across down there. Now, this is just part, my description here so far is just part of what a quantum gravity gradiometer could do away with in a lot of ways. So other than digging, though, how do we know what's underground? And there's lots of, you know, there's different ways to do it, some better than the others, but we've long recognized that gravity detection would be fantastic for these things like common surveys, trying to find out what's under the ground in a limited area, not like for like the southern United States, but like in this area where you're going to do something. So the problem in a nutshell is, what do you think? What's the big problem with using gravity to detect what's under the ground in a small-ish area?
A lot of noise. Yeah. Yes.
Vibrations. The earth is always vibrating from seismic events, human activity, et cetera.
Right.
And you may think seismic events, you know, how often does that happen?
Every second of every day?
Almost every second, because I just went through I looked at a talk I did a couple of years ago. There's a rule that for every one magnitude 7 event, you go down, there's 10 magnitude 6s, and then 100 magnitude 5s, and 1,000. So you keep going down and down that way. You eventually end up with these very, very, very tiny earthquakes that happen all the time, these baby quakes. I think they calculated for Southern California, every 174 seconds, there's a quake that can be detected using the latest techniques. So lots of things are vibrating for lots of reasons. And that noise, that's just noise. And that just swamps out any of the gravity readings that you might want to take of a parcel of land. It just takes way too long. I mean, you could do it, but you're going to have to sit there for a really long time. It's going to cost a ton of money. and, you know, to scan an area. Because the longer you sit there, the more you build up your signal, and then you could overwhelm the noise. But it takes a long time, so it's not done very often. But we know it would be an amazing tool if they can get past some of these problems. And this is exactly what the quantum gravity gradiometer supposedly can do. And it has been, you know, has been shown to work in the field. Professor George Tuckwell, as the director of geoscience and engineering at RSK, said, "Detection of ground conditions such as mine workings, tunnels, unstable ground is fundamental to our ability to design, construct, and maintain housing, industry, and infrastructure. The improved capability that this new technology represents could transform how we map the ground and deliver these projects." All right. So how does this work? So the active ingredient in this tech is an amazing thing called an atomic interferometer. Amazing. So now we've discussed interferometry, right, with light before, right? We've done that before. And I'm going to do it again because I could say it in an even better way than I said it last time, I think. A laser beam is split, right? You got a laser beam. It's split by a half-mirrored silver or a beam splitter, right? So the light has two possible paths to take. Equal probability. I can go up or I can just go straight. Now, we know that if you don't try to determine which specific path the light takes, in a very real sense, light takes both of those paths at the same time. Right? That's superposition, which is a top three of the natural scientific wonders of the universe, in my estimation. Amazing, amazing. Look it up. If you're not familiar with it, look up superposition. It's kind of like the magic of the universe. So now both beams then rejoin eventually, right? That's the design. They join back together, and then the light beams interfere, and it interferes with itself, as all waves can do, right? Producing fringes of light, an interference pattern. So now that pattern can be read. It's like a fingerprint in a lot of ways. It's very specific, and it can be read and interpreted to tell us what happened to make the beams different. What happened to them? What happened in the environment to cause that interference pattern? Very sensitive, very powerful. So now an atom interferometer is the same concept, but pulled off in the opposite way. Instead of a beam of light, it's a beam of atoms. And instead of a solid mirror or a solid beam splitter, it's laser beams, special laser beams that can actually send the atoms down one of two, you know, two possible pathways. So what happens here, do you think? So you got a beam of atoms that then kind of go in different directions. What happens?
Gravity pulls them down.
It's pretty much, well, you're not entirely wrong, Jay, but not where I'm going right now. It's the same thing happens because it splits, goes into two pathways at the same time if you're not looking at it, because matter is waves as well. These atoms are waves as well, and therefore could also produce interference fringes. Thank you, Louis de Broglie. He's the one, wasn't Einstein, it's de Broglie who came up with this, I believe, the very first person that said matter has waves. And one of the things that could impact these interference fringes caused by matter is gravity itself. That's one of the things that will have an impact on those fringes that can be identified. So now the researchers have taken an atomic interferometer and a quantum gravity gradiometer. They've taken it out of the lab. This is now out of the lab for the first time, and they've proved that it works in the real world. And the expectation now, and it seems pretty clear from what I know, that this can have it's going to revolutionize or at least have a major impact on many things, including geophysics, which is the focus of this specific application. So now this new lens into the domain of the underminers could do things like cause ground surveys to go from a month to a few days. So instead of doing a survey for 30 days, you can knock it out in a long weekend. Done.
Wow.
And construction costs and delays should go down in a lot of cases. They could also discover hidden natural resources and structures. They could actually view archaeological discoveries without excavating.
That's the cool
without
stuff.
Excavating.
Yeah, that's
you know,
very cool.
I mean, you can get some pretty good detail too. You know, in later iterations of this technology, potentially. There's also things that it could do to help mitigate some of the devastating impacts that we are certainly going to be seeing due to climate change. Right. So, for example, using this technology, we could refine flooding models and improve safety in flood zones. That's going to be very important in the future. Another one here, Steve, you'll like this one. This technology could help provide effective storage for CO2, kind of insulating it from the atmosphere underground, right? Carbon sequestration. That's going to be huge. We're going to be hearing a lot about that in the news in the coming generation, and this could actually help with that. So that's all cool and interesting. But the real news item here, I think, is kind of buried. They kind of buried the lead here a little bit, because if you step back from the quantum gravity gradiometer and you look at the atomic interferometer itself, I think you could see that it's going to have similar impacts to a lot of other fields as well. A lot of other fields as well. And it could be revolutionary, I think. And I think this is going to get a lot of Nobel Prizes in the next decade or so. So, because what you have it, when you have a well-built and functioning atomic interferometer, you essentially have an amazingly sensitive sensor. It's a sensor in a lot of ways. Now, matter waves can be 10,000 times smaller than a typical light wave that's used for interferometry. 10,000 times smaller, 10,000 times more sensitive. So the things that you could do with this can really kind of sound astounding. With it, you could detect the most minute amount of inertial motion, gravity acceleration, direction, and more. So think about that. Think about what I just said. If this thing can detect with exquisite sensitivity motion, acceleration, and direction, what can you do? How about putting one of these in a car and you tell the system, here's where you are. Now that's it. Then you isolate the car from all electronics and Wi-Fi, everything you can. Then you drive the car for hours. Just drive it for hours, going in anywhere you want to go. And based solely on how the car moved, this device could tell you precisely where you are on the Earth, even what elevation you're at. No GPS required at all, right? That's something that is absolutely possible.
How big is it?
With this? Well, because this is one of the things that makes this very enticing as a gradiometer is the fact that you could put this on a car or a truck to do these surveys. So this is not that big at all. And I don't think it's unreasonable to think that in the future, a lot of cars right now could have something like that where you don't need GPS. Now, of course, you could probably do that now, but you know, you're going to spend $300,000 or maybe $3 million on your car. But as many things with electronics and technology, this could foreseeably be something that a lot of cars could have. Who knows? 20 years, 10 years, 30 years? I don't know. But it's something that should not be a problem. It could also do things like help us refine the fundamental constants that are critical to physics. How about this? For example, what is the recoil velocity of an atom when a single photon hits it?
No idea.
That's the kind of thing that an atomic interferometer could tell us.
Wait, so you don't know the answer?
No, I'm not going to tell you. But these are the kinds of questions that an atomic ferometer could give us. I mean, I'm sure we have an estimate right now, but with a ferometer, because it's so sensitive, we could determine the recoil velocity of an atom when a single photon hits it with much greater precision than we can ever think of doing right now without that device. So that's an example. And that future atomic interferometers could probe the nature of quantum mechanics like never before. Jay, you like a good probing. Like never before with quantum mechanics. So what could we do? We could answer questions like, when precisely do things act like waves or atoms? You know, to really pin that down. You know, what is the nature of reality? In a lot of respects, we'll have a much more confident answer using atomic interferometers and their sensitivity. Okay, so I'm almost at the end, guys. Calm down. I don't want to end with that sentence. So I'm going to end with this anecdote from the scientists who worked with these hyper-accurate atomic interferometers. They went out to lunch. The scientists went out to lunch. They came back, and they're messing with their apparatus, their atomic interferometer, and it declared that the local gravity had changed after they got back from lunch, and that was because of the food in their stomach. The food in their stomach was mass. It had mass. So because there was more mass in the same spot, the gravitational gradient changed enough for this device to detect it.
My God.
So what happened after they pooped?
Then it would go back down. So obviously they either didn't poop more than they ate or they hadn't pooped yet, but they came back after lunch and that's what happened. So I thought that was such an awesome anecdote right there, just to give you an idea of what this is. And I think we're definitely going to be seeing atomic interferometers on the stage in Sweden. To collect a prize at some point or multiple prizes, because these are just like discoveries waiting to be made now with this type of technology, now that it's out of the lab, you know, more fully. Whew, Jesus.
Wow. It still amazes me, like the whole, you know, quantum mechanics is counterintuitive, like in the extreme.
Oh, yeah.
But that we do stuff with it, like it actually works.
Yeah. Modern electronics would not be where it is. The sun could not do what the sun does every millisecond.
But our technology uses quantum effects. Like GPS satellites, make quantum adjustments.
Yeah. The GDP of the entire world that crucially depends on quantum mechanics to be what it is. Without it,
That's amazing.
Love it.
All right, Jay, give us an update on sea level rise due to global warming.
This is not going to be good, guys. So a report was released last week by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You guys have heard of the IPCC.
Yes.
The report goes into detail explaining that global warming is getting markedly worse, which nobody should be surprised about. And without immediate and strong greenhouse gas intervention, the future is grim. One interesting thing that I read that a lot of the climatologists and scientists that work on this information are saying is they're getting emotionally fatigued from creating all these reports over and over, and more and more and more information mounts up and nothing's happening. Very little is happening. And I think that they're hoping that this report, because it's very, very definitive, there is no discussion anymore at all about, is it happening? Of course. It's just a matter of magnitude at this point. And they're finding that it's going to be bad, guys. So the report was written by 270 researchers from 67 countries, which is great because it's a global effort. And the paper concludes that nations are currently barely making a difference and that immediate and profound measures need to be taken. Particularly, sea level will rise 1 foot by 2050. You know, 2050, it sounds like it's far away. It's not. It's 28 years away. It's not far away. 28 years goes by very, very quickly, especially if you're an adult. You'll know, like, you know, 28 years, your kids are grown all of a sudden and they're off to college. And then, you know, that's it, 28 years. By 2100, it could be up to 2 feet. And if little or no measures are taken to, you know, counteract the global warming that we all know about, the oceans will rise a total of 7 feet by then.
What?
Right. So this is why they're saying that seawalls aren't going to be enough to mitigate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely true because we just don't know. Like right now, guys, it's not happening. Nothing is happening.
Well, and not just that. Seawalls are not going to keep out 7 feet of ocean rise.
Right,
nope. Yeah.
8 feet wall, 8 foot walls right now. I mean, that's not going to happen.
No, exactly. So, and that's sort of our plan. That's our great plan. We'll just put a fence around it.
Yeah. A mesh fence. That'll do great.
Keep in mind, like these numbers, you know, how accurate can they be? They're accurate. These are averages, I'm telling you, globally, and this is where this news item becomes very interesting. So depending on the location, the numbers can be very different. And you'd think that sea rise would be the same everywhere, but there's other factors involved. Some coasts like Texas that are in the Gulf of Mexico can see up to 2 feet of sea level rise by 2050, comparative to other places, say, that are going to only see 1 foot. Why? What's going on there? This is due to the fact that the land in that area, right? So, you know,
absorbs
the Gulf of Mexico. Think of the Gulf of Mexico and where Texas is. That land is sinking.
What is it sinking?
Oh, no. You had to, didn't you?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Why, Evan, you might ask, why is the land sinking?
I did ask why.
Right, thank you. In this case, it's mostly due to the fact that oil and water have been sucked out of the ground, right? Industry has pulled so much material out of the ground that there is there's a gap that's happening inside the land, and the land is sinking into the open spaces that are there now. And this is called subsidence. So in the Gulf of Mexico, the land is sinking into itself as the sea levels rise. Not a good combination, guys. Not good.
And caused by the same human activity.
Yeah. Conversely, Anchorage, Alaska is expected to have only – oh, wait. I'm saying it wrong. Not only – Anchorage, Alaska is expected to have an 8-inch drop in sea level by 2050. The sea level will go down 8 inches by 2050. This is because during an ice age, glaciers weighed down and compressed Alaska. And as the glaciers melted, the land now is rising back up. And it's still happening today. And you have to think of this in geologic terms. And if George were here, I would have made a joke there, but I can't now. So you have to think in, you know, tens of thousands of years, you know, like the land is slowly like recovering from being smushed by those glaciers. So the sea is actually rising, but the land is rising, you know, enough to make it so the sea level will go down there. That's pretty cool. Now, that's not, unluckily for all of us, that's not going to happen everywhere. That just happens to be Alaska. But I'm just showing you like the differences.
It's also but I mean, the ground is decompressing, if you will, in the United States as well. To a certain extent,
but not enough to counteract like the global problem that we're facing here.
Yeah.
So we have
inches
new,
versus feet, probably.
Definitely, we have new satellites that are going to be able to map the rise and fall of coastlines, and they're saying that these will have extreme precision, like the kind of precision where they can tell the difference between one building to the next, if one will be higher or if one is sinking or going down, and what's the ocean level going to be at all, basically everywhere. Think about that precision. Global warming is also changing the way that the ocean functions. This is like the way that the water moves and what's happening inside of the ocean. There'll be temperature changes and even current changes around the globe. And when the ocean temperature rises, the water itself takes up more space because, that's what happens when water heats up. And this, of course, will do what? It'll cause the sea levels to rise. As the global temperature goes up, some oceans are more susceptible than others, but ocean temperatures will rise and the ocean volume will increase because it's hotter. Parts of the world where the ocean will remain cooler, the sea won't rise as much, but half of the global sea level rise can be attributed to the increase in water temperature. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Wow.
Half. Yep.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Water expands as it heats.
So now let's talk about what what that water is going to be doing. Moderately destructive flooding will happen 10 times more frequently by 2050. Highly destructive flooding will happen 5 times more frequently. And flooding is not the worst of it. Hurricanes, for example, do a great job of rising sea levels and blowing water onshore, right? You guys have seen tons of video of this happening.
Low pressure, yeah.
This means that hurricanes will be intensely more destructive where the sea levels have risen because that it'll be able to bring that water even further into land. It's basically telling hurricanes, come on in, guys, no problem. All is welcome. Bring everything that you got. Give it to us in the worst way that you possibly can. Of course, the best thing we can do is first mitigate global warming. Please, everybody, everywhere, every country needs to get involved. Stand up and make it happen right now. But even our best efforts are not going to stop the sea from rising. It's already, that ship sailed a long time ago. And this means that we'll have to spend an incredible amount of money engineering our way out of some of the future problems that are heading our way. And Kara brought up one of them. Like one idea is, we could build some sea walls to help at least in certain areas, try to keep some of that water from getting to certain places. The Army Corps of Engineers in the United States is building a seawall. They have plans to build one in Miami.
Right. But the point I was making is it won't be enough.
It won't be. And what's funny, Kara, is they're saying there is also an economic component to this. Say rich cities and rich towns can build the seawall and then they're shunting that water to guess who? The poor people. What happens, 10 miles down the road where they stop?
It's a zero-sum planet.
It's just not good. So another thing that they were talking about is building giant coastal barriers, sandbars and things like that, just to help mitigate the energy that's going to be coming to the land from the ocean. But, those efforts, I found out, take a long time, like 20 years long to build. These aren't like things that you just get a machine out there and it happens overnight. It's a very expensive, very difficult thing, and they're not even sure how well they're going to work. So, this problem is coming. It's just a matter of magnitude. And again, we're citizens in nations around the world, guys, right? Everybody listening to this show, we all live somewhere, and there's some type of government that's governing us, and we're just voters, right, at this point, at best, depending on what country you live in. What can we do? Part of it is, public awareness and letting our politicians know that it's a concern of ours. That's a big deal because eventually they're going to have to do something. If they're not going to react to this report, specifically this horrible, unbelievably rock solid report, then it's going to come down to people like us complaining and making waves, good waves.
Of course, there's always uncertainty in all of this science, but the deniers can always emphasize the uncertainty and basically say we should do nothing.
Yeah, banking on uncertainty. Mm-hmm. That's a great strategy.
Good plan.
Let's get started on that right away.
I'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah, but we have to make decisions with uncertainty. But this is like way above the line. I think we, in terms of, this is actionable. And unfortunately, we have to act decades ahead of time. We can't wait until we're sure because then it'll be too late.
We have to fix this yesterday.
Yeah. Right. We're already behind line. Although there's a little bit of good news. That was not really much noticed. I wrote about this on my blog earlier this week. If you look at the IPCC report, the one revision that's happened since the previous report was that there's new evidence about how long would it take for the atmosphere to stop warming after we stop releasing CO2 into the atmosphere, right? So in other words, previously the extrapolation was that the carbon we've already released will continue to warm the climate for decades. But now it looks like it would stop warming the climate within one decade. Like within 10 years, we would flatline. Feasible. It wouldn't come down. That would take thousands of years. But it would at least flatline after only about 10 years instead of continuing to rise for 40, 50 mm-hmm. years. So that's a revision and a good
optimist.
Direction. It may mean that we have a tiny bit more time than we thought. But as Kara said, we're already late. And so we're just not quite as late maybe as we thought we were. It doesn't really change things in that we have to do things right now. But it does mean that if we did dramatically reduce carbon emissions, the warming would stop quicker than we thought, 10, 20 years ago, which is good. So it's an argument for doing something.
Exactly.
For delaying further or not doing something. It's really, I framed it as, like, if you're a nihilist, they go, what's the point? It's too late. It's never a good position anyway, but it's even more not relevant. The nihilism position, I think, is just self-defeating. It's like, no, if we reduced our carbon emissions, it will stop the warming fairly quickly, and give us time to then sequester CO2 and maybe bring the temperatures down to a more historical level. And again, there's no perfect amount of carbon and temperature for the Earth. It's just we don't want to change it too quickly, and we kind of built our civilization around the current climate, and changing it really quickly is going to, cause a lot of harm and displace a lot of people. All right, well, let's move on to some exciting news about NASA funding some really innovative projects. So we talk a lot about space travel, and space travel is very difficult. This is something that Bob Jay and I really delved into on our book, about the future, because, we have to what's space travel going to look like in 100 or 200 years or whatever. And the bottom line is it's really going to suck, and it's going to suck for a very long time. And it's going to be nothing like any science fiction show has ever depicted, because the science fiction, in order to make the story happen, you got to pretend like we could be zipping around the solar system or even interstellar. And, so that your story could be fast paced and people could visit interesting places, whatever. Even hard science fiction has to throw in one or two gimmies to make it all work. But if you just say, what's it really going to be like? It's really hard.
Yeah, Steve, even The Expanse, which is very, very, very hard science, even they've got gimmies so stuff can happen, in a single lifetime type of thing, reasonable time frame.
But it's not that these problems are not solvable. They are. The challenges of space travel for humans, is solvable. Robots have a lot easier time in space than we do. But it's going to take a lot more time, infrastructure, and trade-offs than we've been led to believe by science fiction, if you will. But NASA is trying to chip away at these problems, and one of the things that they're doing is funding innovative research. Like, come up with some interesting ideas to solve these horrific problems of having people in space. So they announced their latest rounds of phase one and phase two grants to do some research, and I wanted to highlight a few of them because that I thought were interesting. So one is what's called HERDS, High Expansion Ratio Deployable Structures. So the high expansion ratio, that means it's an engineered structure that unfolds, right? So it could be packed really tight to fit into the cargo space of a rocket. And then once you get it into orbit, it can unfold to become much bigger. And they have a design, the people who got the grant for this have a design for a structure that has, they say, an unprecedented 150 times expansion ratio.
Cool.
150 times. So they say this is something that could fit into a current, cargo space of a rocket. And when it expands, it'll be like a kilometer big.
But is it made out of like paper?
Oh, okay. No. This would be a station. It's made out of metal.
Cool.
Yeah. So it's you know, a very complicated scissoring, like unfolding kind of a structure. And so they this is a phase two study. So they already completed the phase one study to of like plausibility, proof of concept kind of thing. Now they're like, all right, now we got to work out some more of the details, like really get the structure, you know, get the details down, make sure it reliably deploys, it doesn't jam up, you know. How do we deal with manufacturing errors? Like exactly what are we going to build it out of? They're going to build they say meter scale prototypes to show how it all works with, you know, thousands of links, they say. So once they perfect it, the idea is that this would basically be like a pop-up space station. Now, why does it have to be so big, you might be wondering? And I think, you know, I know Jay and Bob know the answer to this. Evan and Carrie may be suspecting. Why would we need a space station to be really long, let's say? Why is that feature critical for a long occupation space?
Longer is better.
Longer is better.
You mean long down one axis?
Like solar
gravity.
Particles.
Gravity. Artificial gravity. If you're going to rotate it to produce artificial gravity, it's got to be really big. If it's too small, then the people aboard will sense the rotation. It'll cause vertigo and disorientation.
And lots of puke.
Yeah, you need kilometers, which is not good in space. You don't want to puke in that. So you need kilometer-scale structures to be able to generate 1G of artificial gravity at around 1 to 2 RPMs. Anything faster than that is going to cause too much vertigo. So this is a structure that would be that large. Now, of course, the other way you could get there is to take multiple trips and then assemble something huge in space. So that would be sort of the more traditional approach. But that, of course, is much more expensive. If you can get it up there with a single launch and then just pop it open, something that's a kilometer long, you still have to then, you know, there still will be obviously be multiple trips to supply it and I'm sure add electronic equipment and stuff like that. But at least just getting the external structure in place with just a single launch would be a huge advantage.
So Steve, obviously directly relates, but not to the sort of origami situation, but how readily can human beings physiologically, psychologically adapt to the yuckies? Like, is there not a situation in which we can train for something smaller and have like an interim experience and then actually exist? Because I get that in space, we're always trying to, it's like the Henry Ford thing. Like, what do people want? Faster horses. Like, we're trying to make it as much like Earth as possible. Let's approximate Earth's gravity. But is there not a way that we as people can adapt to a different gravity if we do it like kind of stepwise?
Oh, totally. So, you know, NASA is researching multiple approaches to these issues. So one is, as they're happy to tell you when we interviewed them for Nexus last year, is, you know, and a lot of this research is happening aboard the ISS, is basically doing medical biological research to figure out how to adapt people to space, to microgravity, to radiation, etc. But microgravity is
bad for your body.
It's really hard physiologically on people. So, and then in terms of like resilience to vertigo, resilience to microgravity, et cetera, there's a lot of variability in people. So there will be some selection process going on, but they don't want that really to be the solution. Like only the select few who happen to be highly resistant to vertigo get to be on the space station. They want to be able to accommodate, obviously, a wider range of astronauts. But I think, you know, it's inevitable that to some extent, when we start having like permanent occupation of space, that there is going to be some physiological adaptation going on. The question is, depending on how far in the future is it, will there be like genetic engineering adaptation going on? Like we talked about, just this is speculative, but remember the proteins that the tardigrades use to protect their DNA from cosmic rays, you know, incorporating that into human DNA might be and necessary adaptation if you want to be a belter or live on Mars or
belter.
Live on the moon.
I like it.
All right. that's from The Expanse. All right, the next one I want, there's a bunch of these. I'm only going to talk about a couple that I thought were the most interesting. Another one is digital spacesuits. So this is, again, the idea is not new, but it's developing the technology whereby you would scan an astronaut and then like 3D print a bespoke, customized, individual spacesuit.
Yeah, perfect fit.
Why is this important? So in the Apollo era, the Apollo spacesuits that the astronauts used to walk on the moon were individual. They were customized for the individual astronaut. That worked really well in that the astronauts loved them. They said they were very comfortable. They fit perfectly because they were designed for them. The problem is they didn't last that long, right? The moon ate them up.
Oh, yeah.
And they're expensive. So again, if we're going to have a long-term occupation of Mars or the moon or even space, we need spacesuits that are going to be cheaper, more able to mass produce them and replace them and upgrade them, et cetera. So for that reason, with the space shuttle program, NASA went with a modular design. So these spacesuits were no longer individually made for one astronaut. They basically just had different sizes, like a small, medium, large approach with, you know, a modular design. So you could sort of piece a suit together that would fit one astronaut. But one suit would be worn by like 200 different astronauts. So that worked in a sense, but there was a couple of big failure points. One didn't fit everybody, as we learned, you know, not too long ago.
Right.
An EVA had to be delayed because they basically didn't have suits that could fit the astronauts they had on the station. But also the astronauts hate them because they have a lot of pressure points. They have sometimes they don't have the mobility, or they actually literally get injuries because of the pressure points in the suit, or it limits their range of motion, it limits the strength that they have because it's not fitting their joints properly.
Screw that.
Now, the Artemis spacesuits, which are still being developed, and this has been delayed because they're having a hard time, like, really accomplishing what they want to do. But the Artemis is following the space shuttle approach, where they're going to have a modular design, not individual spacesuits for individual astronauts, but they're just going to try to do it better, like have more sizes. And
Extra small and extra large.
Yeah, to have the sort of the best of both worlds. But again, they're having trouble, you know, really making them optimal. So this research program is designed to get us back to the Apollo era, where you have individual spacesuits. But if you could 3D print them cheaply, then you could afford to do a few things. First of all, you could afford to make an individual spacesuit for each astronaut. You can also afford to replace parts as they wear out, right, which is going to be important. And you could also print them on site. You could print them on the moon or on Mars. So again, if you're going to occupy the moon or Mars for a long period of time, the ability to 3D print your spacesuits there is huge. You know, again, this is a phase one research grant. They're just sort of looking into, like, how could we even approach this? How could we accomplish this goal? You know, what technologies would be used? What fabrics, what systems would we use, et cetera? So this could be like the next kind of approach after the Artemis suits that are being developed for the next generation. Maybe by the time we're sending people to Mars, we'll have these customized 3D printed based on body scan, you know, spacesuits. But I think definitely we need to move in this direction, because spacesuits are inherently bulky and uncomfortable, et cetera. Having them really finely fit for each astronaut is like the best way to improve their functionality. The final one I'm going to talk about, again, there was a bunch of them, but the final one I want to talk about was a proposal to deal with cosmic rays.
Yeah, baby.
So we've talked about this before. There is currently no way to shield against cosmic rays. Remember, there's two kinds of radiation in space. There's the solar wind, which is very variable. It could be very minimal, and then there could be a solar storm. But it's more lower energy radiation. We can shield against that, right? Even just like water could shield against solar wind. And astronauts just need to get to a better shielded part of a ship or a station when a storm is coming. But cosmic rays are super high energy, and we have nothing that can effectively shield against them. Obviously, we could just make super thick shielding, but we can't afford the weight to have our rockets or spaceships or whatever shielded. But, you know, on the moon and on Mars, we're going to have to be underground.
Lava tubes, baby.
But even getting to and back from Mars would exceed, you know, an astronaut's lifetime exposure to cosmic rays. So that's a huge problem. So this is a proposal for a system that would at least reduce the issue of cosmic rays. It won't eliminate it. Again, we learned that if you have anything less than complete shielding, it actually makes the situation worse, because
if
any of the cosmic rays get through the shielding, then they're trapped inside where they zip around, causing tons of damage. And so you have to have either like complete shielding or just let it pass through you, you know, and just deal with the background cosmic radiation.
They clearly need the water bear DNA to protect their remember that?
Yeah. Item? Yeah, exactly. So the problem is, what's the exposure? It's like 6 months or something. It's like, you know, maybe you can get to Mars, but it'd be hard to get to Mars and back without exceeding your safe exposure. So again, when we asked NASA about this, what's your plan on dealing with cosmic rays? Their answer was, get there fast.
And deal with it medically, so that's, I think she said too.
Yeah, yeah, and try to figure out how to, you know, treat people so it doesn't, to treat the damage that it does. Not really great. All right, so this is the Crew HAT cosmic radiation extended warning using the Halbach-Torres system. What this basically is a magnetic field. And it's just a magnetic field in a specific design to, so that you can have a very powerful magnetic field outside of the crew compartment, but minimize the magnetic field inside the crew compartment, because it wouldn't be good to have a, you know, really powerful magnetic field where you need to also have electronic equipment and tools and stuff, you know. They calculate, again, this is not just proof of concept kind of thing. They need to build a scale model of this and you know, see if they can get it to work. But they project that a full-scale one could reduce the cosmic rays that reach the crew compartment by 50%.
That's huge. Wow.
Yeah, that would double, basically, the time that astronauts could spend in transit. So that would make getting to Mars much more plausible. So that would be good. And maybe they can get that figure even higher. You know, who knows? And again, this is diverting the cosmic rays, so it doesn't have the problem of trapping them like insufficient shielding would have. So, yeah, so that, and this is something that we've mentioned before. Like, yeah, use magnetic fields, but it would be really difficult, et cetera, et cetera. But now they're trying to actually design.
But 50%, yeah, but, you know, something.
Yeah, but 50% is 50%. So, you know, it's all about time. So if we can get there faster and we could slow down the rays and maybe give them some of that tardigrade, you know, proteins to protect the DNA.
Combination.
Whatever. We get to the point where, yeah, that where, you know, you could spend years in space. Right, if you had to, and that's going to be like traveling is the big problem. If you're in a low Earth orbit station, you're protected by Earth's magnetic field. If you're on the Moon or Mars, you could be underground. But if you're traveling between locations, that's where you get your exposure, because spaceships just can't be shielded. It would be way too heavy. I also think we're going to need to if we're going to like regularly be going. This is again where we get back to this idea of, the space travel infrastructure is going to be complicated and multifaceted. For example, we may need to build a ship, like a train that goes back and forth from the Earth to Mars. And once you know, this ship could be big. It could be big enough to rotate, even maybe. It could be shielded, because it could be basically be like a hollowed out asteroid or something. And then once you get it on that trajectory where it's basically in an orbit that takes it from the Earth to Mars and back again, you can just accelerate astronauts in a rocket, get them to that ship. But then they spend, you know, most of the journey in a heavily shielded large ship, you know, where they're not exposed to cosmic rays. Something like that will also have to be done if we're going to be regularly traveling in space. But the idea of, like, when you watch any science fiction movie, like, oh, we're going to get in the Millennium Falcon, zip into space and fly around in the Millennium Falcon, you just have to assume, they're just ignoring the problem. And if you're going to try to retcon it, you just have to assume that whatever that glass they're looking through is some magical material that completely shields them from cosmic rays, even though they never mention it. But and sometimes, like in some science fiction, they're like even exposed to space. You know what I mean? There is no shielding, no mention of how it's being dealt with. But that's going to be, cosmic rays are going to be like the main limiting factor on traveling in space.
It's saying it for years.
We should have listened to you, Bob. Why didn't we?
But it's good to know that NASA is like, you know, these are significant grants, you know, but they're spreading their bets out. This is just like, yeah, just find some solutions to these problems, you know?
Yeah, they're pretty big, pretty important.
Kara, you're going to talk about, this is a tricky issue. This is going to take a bit. It has come up previously on the SGU. I know we talked about it even before you were on the show, Kara. But the idea of whether or not biological sex is strictly binary. And
spoiler, it's not.
Spoiler, it's not. And which we have said before. Now, I do want to frame this up a little bit, before you launch into
this
discussion, because obviously there is now a political culture context here, and which means that people have a lot of strong opinions about it, even skeptics. This is one of those issues where I find that skeptics are divided mainly because they're poorly informed. And so that is an opportunity. And of course, that is a situation that is entirely fixable, right? Because skeptics, I think, are good at responding to actual information.
So do you think for especially within the skeptic community, that this is more of a knowledge deficit problem than, let's say, a motivated reasoning problem?
No, it's both. Because people who have the knowledge deficit problem are the same people who have the motivated reasoning.
Right.
But so it's very similar to the anti-GMO issue. Like the people who were anti-GMO were anti-GMO for ideological reasons, but it was fueled by direct misinformation about GMOs, about the technology, about the history, et cetera. With these issues, I like to start with the science. But just to frame it up just very, very, very quickly, this has to do with trans healthcare, right? That's what this is about. And this is obviously now the latest culture war that is happening. But there's actually four issues here. And they don't necessarily all have to line up in one direction or another. And we're only going to talk about the most basic layer, which is a scientific question, is biological sex binary? But also there's the question then of what should be the approach to trans healthcare. And there's two models. There's the gender-affirming model and the gender-critical model. So that's one debate. And then even within the gender-affirming model, there's questions about individual medical interventions and is the risk-benefit there? What's the evidence, et cetera? And then the final layer is what are the ethics of doing these kind of interventions on minors, on people who are not yet independent adults? And what do you do if a child and a parent disagree with whether or not they should have a medical intervention? So we're not going to get into all of those things. And of course, that blends into what about sports and all this other stuff and bathrooms
especially,
and everything.
Especially not with regards to the transgender community. I think maybe there will be some little touches when we talk about intersex individuals, which we'll get to, because sometimes a medical decision has to be made. And so what is the approach there? But I completely agree, Steve. Like, what I think we should do today is just lay the groundwork for this very question. Even backing away a little bit, just to be clear, I want to kind of make a clear statement about the fact that there are a lot of different ways to slice and dice sex and gender. And, you know, you hear a lot of terms being thrown around: cisgender, transgender, lesbian, gay, bisexual, intersex, non-binary. And I think a lot of times people put all these things in the same box. And there are a lot of really good educational tools online. One that we often use in psychology training, you can Google it, is called the genderbread person. And it actually shows the difference between sort of like there's gender identity, there's attraction, both sexual and romantic, there's gender expression, there's sex, different sex characteristics, and what are those? And so today what we're going to focus on is sex.
Biological.
And when I say sex,
I
don't mean like we're going to be talking about the fun thing that we call sex. I'm talking about the sex, like the biological sex or the characteristics of sex or all the different ways that we can talk about the traditional, which we know is definitely not accurate, binary of male versus female sex. I think that maybe in future conversations, we could have conversations about gender. We could have conversations about identity and expression. But right now, we're going to focus specifically on this concept of what is biological sex? How do we define it? Is the term biological sex the most appropriate? And then, of course, is it binary? And like we said, spoiler, it's not. But I like this approach of thinking of it as being bimodal. And so I think we'll start there and then we'll sort of backtrack. So when we talk about bimodality, I'm not sure if that's a concept that comes naturally to a lot of people. I don't know if you guys remember way back in like your early math classes when you learned measures of central tendency, but you learned about the mean, median, and the mode, right? The average, the median. And these are all different ways to say that's sort of the central point of a population or of a sample. So we often talk about the average. That's if you add everybody up and then divide by the number of everybody's. And then we say on average, you know, on average, people have two arms, but not everybody has two arms. On average, people, you know, have, I don't know, brown eyes, but of course not everybody has brown eyes. But on average, we could say that. And then you have the median, which is sort of the point in a row of frequencies that falls in the middle. And that's not always going to give you the same answer as the mean. And then you have the mode. And the mode is, let's say we're looking at a certain feature, eye color, and we want to say, you know, we take a group of kids in a class, and then we say, what color are your eyes? And for every blue-eyed person, we put a tick mark in that column. For every brown-eyed person, we put a tick mark. For every green-eyed person, we put a tick mark. And then we'll see, you know, what is the mode? It's the most frequent expression. So when we talk about something being bimodal, it literally looks like a normal curve, except it has two bumps instead of one. Can everybody envision that? And the big difference here, you know, we're talking about something that's kind of visual using statistics on an auditory platform. But the big issue here is that in between those two bumps, in between those two modes, there is a fuzzy area. And when we think about something as being binary, we're trying to define it as though it's either or. Either everybody falls as being biologically male, or everybody falls as being biologically female. But the truth of the matter is there are fuzzy individual cases in which that sort of taxonomy simply isn't sufficient. And so we're not saying here that there are 400 genders. We're not saying here, and maybe, you know, depending on your categorizational system, you could list a lot of different concepts of gender. But when we specifically are talking about sex, which refers to a lot of different things, it refers to your genotype, it refers to your external or internal genitalia, it refers to your gametes, sperm versus egg, it refers to sex hormones. But sadly, we can't take any of those one things out of context. They all play on each other. So there's a very strong nature-nurture component here. There's the genetics. This is what is coded in your DNA. And then there's the sort of epigenetic phenomenon, the environmental phenomenon of the environment of gestation. What we end up seeing is that in close to 2% of, especially here in the US, because that's where we're pulling our numbers, of the general population, close to 2% of births don't fall cleanly into the sex binary. And there are a lot of different examples of that. So I mentioned before this term intersex. So intersex individuals are individuals where it's not a very clean distinction. And it could be for any of the reasons that I just mentioned. It could be, for example, and maybe Steve, you can help me come up with some of these examples, like a baby that's born with a larger than normal clitoris that is kind of hard to tell at birth whether that's actually penile tissue or clitoral tissue, because of course they come from the same developmental tissue. Or it could be a baby that's born with both a vagina and testes. It could be a baby that's born with ovaries and testes or neither of those gonads. There are a lot of different examples of intersex. It's not one thing.
Yeah, one dramatic example is, you know, there are people walking around today who were identified as female when they were born. They are women, right? They look like women. They live their life as a woman,
right? So they have a female gender identity also.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. Right? The external genitalia, everything. They have no idea that they are XY chromosome. No idea, right? Because they're XY, but they developed along a female biological pathway because of their receptors were insensitive to hormones, right? So
right, insensitive signal, to testosterone.
Yeah, so the signal didn't get through, and therefore to basically make them develop along the male pathway, so they develop along the female pathway even though they're XY. So the thing, one way to look at this, so again, yeah, it's sex is still bimodal. There is no third sex. There's no other axis. It's just the male-female axis. But every aspect blends in a complicated way in the middle, and you can have almost any permutation of the different kinds of features that are typically male or typically female. And any scheme that you come up with to say that it's strictly binary breaks down in the middle. Like, so you can't say it's chromosome. If you were XY, you're male. But what about XY females? You can't say it's gametes because there are literally people who have ovosperm. They have mixed gametes. There is no biological marker that's 100% binary in terms of male or female. It all breaks down in the middle. And of course,
it all breaks down in the middle.
Of course, the brain is a sexual organ as well. And there are features of you know, in terms of sexual attraction and also gender identity that are developmental and along this, you know, sexually dimorphic system in the brain. And so that's part of sex too. You know, part of biological sex is your sexual orientation and your gender identity.
And your gender identity. Yeah. It's who you're attracted to. It's how you identify as yourself in the world. It's all of these different components that, by the way, don't follow the same path. And I think that's where the genderbread person like teaching tool can be really important, because I think for those who just simply live in regions or live in communities for which they haven't had overt exposure to people who are different from themselves, unfortunately, they may make assumptions that if somebody has a specific gender identity, they necessarily then have a specific sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. And that is simply not true. All of these things can vary in all of these directions. So somebody can be a, you know, cis woman who is a lesbian. Somebody can be a trans man who is attracted to women or is attracted to men or is attracted to both. And so that's why it's really important that we sort of look at those things separately. But kind of going back to the point you were making, Steve, almost thinking about it from like a bottom-up developmental model, all along the pathway, there can be differences.
Yeah.
So like you said, there can be basic genetic, we're talking like karyotype, like chromosomal differences. There are people with Turner syndrome, which is XO. It's a single X chromosome and no second chromosome. There is Klinefelter syndrome, which is XXY. There are individuals who, we know that there are a lot of individuals, kind of the quote, super male syndromes, which is not, I think, a very good term, but you often hear it, who are X with multiple Ys. And so not only can the chromosomes differ, but then you can have, like you mentioned, sensitization to sex hormones that differ based on different developmental things that can happen in the womb. So maybe
there and also genetics, like there's like 16 other genes that influence the response of cells
to sex hormones.
How about this, Kara? There are hybrids, right? There are people who have some of their cells are XY and some of their cells are XX.
Yeah, it's like a chimeric.
Yeah, they're chimeras. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really cool.
Not a hybrid,
and so, across the board, we see this. So we've got, you know, differences in chromosomal makeup. We've got differences in sensitization or quantity of sex hormones during development. We also then, what that leads to sometimes is differences in both internal and external genitalia, and also differences in gonads and gametes, right? So the genitalia being the gonads, but the actual gonads that are responsible for producing gametes, and then the gametes themselves, the sperm and the egg, as you mentioned. And so some people don't produce either, some people produce both. And here's the rub, is that very often, and we think about this sadly from a sort of efficiency perspective, but when we think about the development of a fetus, one way to view it, which I don't know if it's really the best way, but Steve, this is how we learned about it in developmental biology, and you took it before I did, so I assume you learned about it this way too, is that sort of the default development is female. And then female fetuses can become masculinized by testosterone.
Yeah, that was the dogma when I was in
biology
as well.
And I think that a lot of people still sort of stick with this dogma, although it's obviously a lot more complicated than that.
More complicated than that, yeah.
Totally more complicated. But so what ends up happening is that sadly, when a child is born intersex, or a child is born with, let's say, forward-facing external genitalia that's ambiguous, very often, historically, the decision was made in the room to perform a surgery that very often feminized, because it was simply easier to cut away than it was to reshape. And so the surgery, which was made long before the child hit puberty, long before the child developed a gender identity, long before anybody knew what different features were happening within the child's brain, which of course, as we mentioned, the brain is a part of a sex organ, right? It has these features necessarily sort of coded into it and also changing with epigenetics and with experience. And sadly, this decision was made for the child before anybody had any real evidence as to this child's sex. Mm-hmm. And maybe that child would have grown up to identify as male. Maybe that child would have grown up to identify as non-binary. Maybe the intersex, a phenotype, the intersex phenotype would have translated to a sort of non-binary gender identity. But the fact is, we never know. And this is where we often will see gender dysphorias.
Yeah, but to clarify, today that doesn't happen. And
right, but there are a lot of people walking around today who experience that.
Absolutely. But the more of the standard now is, so unfortunately, children are assigned a biological sex at birth based upon a casual look at their external genitalia.
Right, a glance. Like, does it look more like a pee-pee?
Do they have a penis or a vagina?
Yeah,
if they have a
exactly.
penis, it's a boy. If they have a vagina, it's a girl. And as I said, they could have a vagina but be XY, but no one's going to do that investigation, right? But if they have ambiguous genitalia, they don't just say, okay, we're going to choose female and then cut off
point,
what's there. They will look at the chromosomes. They will look at genetics. They will look at hormone levels. They will do a more thorough analysis. So that is more the standard today, which is good.
Which is good. It's moving in the right direction, but it still takes the decision out of the hands of the individual themselves.
Of the child, right.
Yeah. And it sort of is still a best approximation based on the available evidence at the time, mm-hmm. which may or may not reflect the experience during development. Because
right.
when a child is born, they haven't yet gone through puberty. They haven't yet experienced levels of development.
You cannot tell someone's sexual orientation by looking at their genitalia at birth.
Oh, God, no.
Right? I mean, do we all agree with that? And the idea that like sexual orientation is a social choice or it's whatever is obviously discredited and
absolutely,
know, and is a homophobic kind of stance. By the same token, you cannot tell someone's gender identity by looking at their genitalia at birth mm-hmm. either. It's bimodal, so 98% of the time mm-hmm. you'll be correct. But we're talking about the 2% where that assumption turns out to be more complicated or it's just essentially not correct.
And even if we look at the low end of that, like 0.1 to 0.2% of births where there really is ambiguous or like intense variation in genital anatomy, that still translates
to a lot of people.
Thousands of babies born every year. And I think, what's the estimation, like 40 million adults?
Yeah, it's a lot of people.
And so that's why when people sort of, I think, minimize the idea of, well, what is the difference between a binary and a bimodal if we're just talking about, you know, 1 or 2% in the middle? Well, how many people live in this country?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Those are the people we're talking about, right?
Yes.
That's the thing that makes no sense. Like, yeah, those are the exceptions. That's pathology, whatever dismissive term you'll say. It actually isn't. This is just part of the variation of humanity. Right.
Yeah, part of normal variation.
Yeah, this and animals too. Like this is just, in animals, it's even more incredible. You know how much diversity mm-hmm. there is in biological sex. But
oh yeah.
I mean, and the things like everything in biology, we think of archetypes. Like even with like a species, there's an archetype of a species. But in reality, there is no simple categorization in biology because all boundaries are fuzzy. That's just the way biology works. It is messy. And just from a skeptical, logical point of view, we encounter this a lot. Like people who don't like the proposed solutions to climate change argue climate change isn't real. Rather than saying, okay, well, climate change is real, I just don't like your proposed solution. Like that's too much nuance for the average person, right? Everyone, they want everything to be lined up in the same way. So there is a legitimate conversation to have about how to optimally treat people who identify as transgender. In terms of medical interventions, the state of the evidence, all of that. That's where the conversation should be had. But for the people who, in my experience, who take the gender critical approach also deny that biological sex, bimodal and not binary. And they make really simplistic arguments about how biology is binary. And then they try to take like the skeptical scientific high ground by saying, if you don't believe that, you're somehow delusional or politically correct. It's like, no, you're just biologically ignorant. That is not the way biology works. Or you could, again, you could try to wave it away by saying, well, those are the exceptions. But it's like, no, those are people. And those are the people we're talking about, the people who don't completely fit into one of these two buckets.
And that's the point. Yeah. Just like we've heard that statement over and over that, like, it doesn't matter if you believe that the sun will rise tomorrow, it's good, or that you believe the earth is round, you know, whatever. Like, the sun's going to come up regardless. And here's the thing. Whether you believe this or not, these are real people, real human beings.
Well, right, the humanity of it all.
Yeah, and when we say you don't exist, or your identity does not, and not just your identity, but your experience as a human being is somehow wrong, or it's not fitting in the mold the appropriate way, what you're actually doing is you're minimizing their existence.
Yeah, it's total dehumanization.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're trying to define them out of existence, actually.
Up to 1.7% of the U.S. population, it's estimated, are intersex. Mm-hmm. So they have anatomy and physiology that present specifically as intersex. That's 5 million people.
Yeah.
5 million
you're
people.
Alone. Yeah.
And that's just intersex individuals. We're not even talking about gender identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the more subtle changes, yeah.
And what happens when we sort of codify a system that utilizes a gender binary as opposed to a gender bimodal distribution with a fuzzy demarcation in the middle is that we necessarily make systems that don't allow for these people to hold space. And we see examples over and over. Mm-hmm. If somebody is identified as intersex, neither male nor female, how do they operate in a world that forces them to choose at every turn? And that's the real issue, I think, when the social justice conversation comes up. But it's rooted in science. And the science shows, even as something as simple, and I shouldn't say simple, but as clear as day as the intersex individual, that individual exists in the world and that individual faces these issues. You know, this is not even before we start to talk about gender identity.
Yeah.
I think this is a good starting point to look at the science because it's so clear, yet it still drives, I think, a lot of debate that, as you mentioned, Steve, often is really steeped in motivated reasoning.
Yeah. And again, I think I've seen it go both ways. Like, people are starting from a misconception about biological sex, and that kind of sends them on the wrong path in terms of thinking about the implications of it. But I also see people working the other way. Like, they're starting with more of an ideological position, and then and then they backfill in, well, sex is binary, so that justifies my position. So again, we're not trying to even take any firm positions on the social, you know, medical, political issues here. Just, if we're going to have this conversation, we have to start from the common ground of what the science says. At least don't deny the science or pretend that it's something that it isn't. And you can still get to a lot of different positions starting with legitimate science, but let's at least do that. And don't immediately have this knee-jerk, well, you know, anything that's not binary is pseudoscience and you're just delusional or fooling yourself. It's political correctness. We're substituting political correctness for science. Nope, we're recognizing the science. You're the one who's not recognizing the science.
We're taking a bottom-up approach.
The bottom line is, for a lot of these questions, there's no right or wrong answer. Like, the sports question, I personally think, like, there's no right or wrong answer here. It's there's no perfect way to do this that's perfectly fair to everybody, because the system is messy. It's not going to fit any clean categorization system that we want or maybe need to use for something like a competitive sport. So we just have to pick our poison. You know, we have to figure out what's going to be the best compromise. It's like, I equated it with like planets and dwarf planets. Is that an objective demarcation line? Of course not. It just has to serve some purpose for us. You know,
that sort of idea, and this isn't even a conversation that we had. It's a deeper conversation, and it really does relate to the demarcation problem, right? Yeah. Between like what is science and pseudoscience. This idea of taxonomy, of taking a sort of, quote, natural order in the world and then trying to bucket it and trying to describe it using very specific language always bites us in the ass.
Yeah.
Because there is always an exception to whatever taxonomic rule we have developed.
Right.
And we have to be careful and we have to be so humble to remember that even the words male and female are human conventions. Mm-hmm. They're labels we use to describe things that we see as different. But there's always going to be a wiggly, fuzzy place where we can't cleanly demarcate. And what we don't want to do is we don't want the people who fall in that place to feel as though their humanity is lost. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's, you know, I made the point earlier and I just want to sort of reiterate it before we finish is exactly what you were talking about, Steve, that like sometimes the motivated reasoning comes from a place that's like agenda driven. Sometimes it comes from a place of lack of knowledge. Sometimes it comes from a place that's agenda driven. I think sometimes the hybridization of those two things, the hybridization comes in when there's misunderstanding again about the differences between biological sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, all these different measurements that are discrete. They are discrete things that can be related but don't necessarily go together. And I think oftentimes this feels like a complicated topic and people lump it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two very separate things. And that's not to belittle. I do think these arguments about transgender rights are valid and they're important. But here on this show, we are a science show. We wanted to get down to the science.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you have to agree that climate change is happening. And then you could talk about what to do about it.
Exactly. Right? And maybe listen to the people who are most affected by the climate change. Don't sit and talk about it in a room and not let those people into the conversation because they're the ones who are actually dealing with it. And I think that that's another point that we often
Sure. But in this case, this is also a case where it's like, just talk to an expert. The experts, there's no controversy here when you're talking about actual experts. You know what I mean? You say the idea that biological sex is strictly binary is like laughably naive, and any expert will tell you that there is a strong consensus here because the evidence is really blatant. You know,
right? And any quote expert that argues against it, if you dig deep enough, you'll realize A, there's motivated reasoning there, and B, they're very likely not an expert in that field.
Yeah, they're not an appropriate.
They're probably like, oh, a social psychologist or something who's arguing that, or you know, somebody who's like a different kind of biologist who actually never studied the core literature that's involved here.
Right. Yeah. Just talk to an expert. You know, they'll lay it out for you.
Steve, should you talk to an expert or should you talk to a sexpert?
Oh, I like that.
A sexpert?
I like that.
Yes.
Sexpert.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
All right, Jay.
Yes.
It's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Before I start Who's That Noisy, I'm going to play something that was sent to me by a listener named Andrew.
Who cares? Holy shit, that was good.
I love that so much.
Mashup.
Habitable.
Were they all different, like from different?
Yes, they're all different.
Oh my God.
That's mostly Steve with a little bit of Bob, I think.
There's a couple of Bobs in there.
I think a couple of Bobs.
Yeah.
That's fun. Now, you think about like what? How many times do we say certain words on the show? Like, yeah, you know, a lot of them come up all the time.
Oh, it's such a good word. It just rolls off the tongue, or I guess off the lips. Habitable.
He had that phenomenon happen to him because he kept hearing the word where the word started to not make sense.
Right.
Oh yeah, semantic. Right. What's that called again? They talk about it in Ted Lasso.
Really? Yeah, where the word loses its qualia.
It just becomes a noise and it doesn't cease to become a word.
The word loses its
aluminium
meaning. It's called semantic satiation.
Oh, I like it.
Appropriate.
Nice. Yeah. Makes sense.
That happened to me with the word
I'm so
orange.
So full of that word.
Orange. Yeah.
Like the word absolutely orange lost its meaning. I'm like, what does it mean? Oh my God. It's very confusing. All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so something's going on there. Did you guys want to take a stab at this one before I move on, or?
No, I have no idea.
Okay, yeah.
It's kind of hard to hear, but maybe like diamonds? Was it like diamonds being thrown into a jar?
like we are all wont to do.
Oh, I love that. I wish I had diamonds to just throw into a jar.
Just sprinkle them into the jar.
Pearls to throw before swine, but not diamonds to jars.
So Jay Will wrote in and said, hello, is it the sound of someone creating a Prince Rupert's drop? So do you guys know what that is?
No.
Prince Rupert. Wasn't that from Shrek?
It's not the pitch drop, is it?
So a Prince Rupert's drop is when you take molten glass. Did I just gunk? Did I just make a...
Yeah. Molten.
Molten. A Prince Rupert's drop is when you take molten glass and you drop a portion of it, a small portion of it, into a cold bucket of water, say. So there's a glob of frozen glass at the end, but it has a long tail. Okay? And some phenomenon happens, and I remember learning about it, and I don't know why physically it does this anymore, but... It becomes incredibly durable, that nodule of glass, that blob of glass that hardened. And it's damn near unbreakable, right? You know, and don't get crazy. I don't mean like, yeah, it's going to break, but people have hit these with hammers and they're super durable. There's something that happens in the arrangement
of the crystals.
Yeah. But if you break the tail, the whole thing shatters.
Oh, cool.
It's fascinating.
It's lines of force.
Yes, that's right, Steve. So look it up on YouTube if you don't know what they are. It's really cool. So what this listener is saying is he thinks this is the formation of one of those where you take the molten glass and you drop it into the bucket of water. I think it's a very good guess, very interesting. Jay Will, good guess. You're wrong, but I totally get why you said that. Another listener named Kay Dingwell said, hi, all. Is this week's Who's That Noisy? A bullfrog. Thanks for all the work that you do. No, but, well, you stumbled on something. There is something making a weird noise in there, right? There's like that repetitive noise. What's making that noise? We'll see. Let's continue investigating. So Phil Wyman wrote in, hi, Jay. Is the noisy for this week a goose? Maybe someone is attracting it with food in a bowl or jar, and hence the rattle. No, it's not. I was trying to think here. That noise that you hear that I just referenced, sure, geese make kind of like a honky noise like that. I've heard that noise before, but this is not a goose. Let's keep going. I got a couple more for you guys. A listener named Zach Gordon wrote in and said, Jay, I feel so confident about my first Who's That Noisy guess that I am second guessing myself, but here it goes anyway. The noisy this week is the pill being dropped into a glass beaker containing a water-like liquid in a magnetic chemical mixer, like those found in most chem labs, and beginning to mix via spinning the solution. So I've seen these. I don't know if you guys have, but you probably have. It's one method that a chemist could use to mix liquids that are in a beaker. It's essentially like a magnet. It's something that can be magnetized that's spinning around inside the beaker. So there's something on the outside of the beaker that is moving the magnetized thing that's inside the beaker, and that creates a spinning force. That's a good guess. Not correct, but I do see why you said that as well. And we have the last listener guess that we have today is Howard Cordingly. Hello, Howard. He says, hi, Jay. My now six-year-old, his birthday was last week, wanted to guess who's that noisy. He says it sounds like ice water in a glass and someone drinking from it.
Cute.
Yeah. So you know what? There is a water thing involved with this. Now, your son is not correct, but not completely, completely incorrect, because there is a water component to this. I'm going to tell you what the answer is because there was no winner. Guys, believe it or not, this is the sound of a red-bellied piranha. And these piranha...
The red-bellied ones?
Yes, let me play it for you again. This is a red-bellied piranha, and it's making this noise as it's being held out of water. So clearly this piranha is complaining about being out of water temporarily. And these piranha, just so you know, yes, they are the flesh-shearing type of piranha.
Oh, I saw the movie.
The skeletonizing version.
Piranha 2, Piranha 3.
Yeah, they call it – it's a carnivorous fish that inhabits wild rivers of South America and might be best known for its unique sharp rows of teeth and bloody-minded craving for meat.
Yeah, my – certainly not known for its fashion sense.
That they're portrayed in the movies, by the way.
But you know,
yeah, they're really little.
That's disappointing.
They do eat meat. They eat flesh. There's probably a zombie version of them too, but I haven't seen it. All right, that's that. So, you know, thank you for sending in your guesses, guys. I have a new Noisy for you guys this week. It was sent in by a listener named Viced Rhino, probably their nickname, and check it out. That is the Noisy for this week, guys. It's not an easy one, I'll tell you that much. If you have an idea of what this Noisy is, or if you heard something cool this week, all you got to do, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
It was the sound of Bob not being impressed by something.
All right, thanks, Jay. Guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items for facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There is a theme this week. We haven't had a theme in a bit. The theme is Ukraine. So three facts about Ukraine. Can't complain about that. You guys ready?
Let's do it.
Here we go. Item number one. Ukraine produces more sunflower seeds than the rest of the world combined. Item number two. Ukrainians rarely smile in public and, in fact, would find it rude if you smiled at them. And item number three. The world's deepest metro station is in Kyiv, Arsenalna Station at 105.5 meters. Kara, go first.
I mean, the one that like gets me is this idea of like smiling. I mean, that's the one that sticks out the most to me. Like, Ukrainians don't smile in public. So, I mean, that's the one I keep grabbing on to. Like, Ukrainians don't smile? What? Or rarely smile in public, right? You can't say they don't ever. Like, is that a cultural thing? Is it, I don't know, like it would have to be cultural, right? But I thought that smiles, like laughter, were sort of like a universal human expression. And then the world's deepest metro station, I don't know, that could be totally, like that's just like weird trivia. Like I have no idea. And then Ukraine produces more sunflower seeds than the rest of the world combined. I am remembering, I do make a connection in my mind with sunflowers and Ukraine. So I think I'm going to say the smile one is false. That's just weird. That's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Smile, weird, fiction.
All right, Jay.
Wait. Bob, you just gave me whiplash, for Christ's sake.
Hey, it's good to be pithy once in a while on science or fiction.
I mean, who knows? Nobody knows this shit. Going first, you should be happy, Carrie. You should be very happy.
This is Bob's frustration because he spent hours looking at science stories today. And
okay, so the first one here about sunflower seeds, I think that one is science. The second one here, Ukrainians rarely smile in public and, in fact, would find it rude if you smiled at them. I find that one a little hard to believe. This one's difficult. It might maybe, but I don't know. I don't know. And the third one, the world's deepest metro station is in Kyiv. It's called, how do you pronounce that, Steve?
Arsenalna.
Arsenalna Station at
105. I'm just phonetically pronouncing it.
105.5 meters. That is damn far. Why would they have a metro station that far down? That one seems like the fiction to me. I'm going to say that the subway station, the metro station, is the fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
Oh, boy. sunflowers. I think that one's science. The lower half of the Ukraine flag, I believe, is sunflower yellow. I don't know if that has some significance. The one about smiling in public, you know, there are cultures in the world in which it's considered rude to make eye contact, for example. So, but I'd not heard about the smiling one. That seems sort of unusual. And the deepest metro station, you know, why? I guess the only thing you could think about there is why would it be 105.5 meters, you know, 300 feet below. That is pretty deep, like Jay says, but the one about smiling, I don't think that one's going to be right. So, smiling fiction.
Okay, so you guys are split between the second and third one, so you all agree on number one, so we'll start there. Ukraine produces more sunflower seeds than the rest of the world combined. You all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Sorry, oh, I knew we'd make that association.
The sweep. The pain of the sweep.
Now, Kara, that's a reasonable association to make because Ukraine is the number one producer of sunflower seeds.
Just not combined.
Just not more than the rest of the world combined. They produce 17.5 million metric tons of sunflower seeds per year, but Russia produces 15.5 and European Union 10.4, et cetera. So there's, they're not even close to being more than the rest of the world combined. They're just the most, more than any other individual producer of sunflower seeds. Now, Ukraine is the largest country in Europe. Do you guys know that?
And it's space-wise, yes.
And it is the breadbasket of Europe. It produces a lot of wheat, a lot of other products, and one of those things that it produces is sunflower seeds. So, and sunflower seed oil as well.
And we all, of course, saw the woman. Well, I think sunflowers are their like national flower, but we all saw the woman during the resistance, that video that went viral, saying, you know, to the Russian soldier, "Put these
sunflower
seeds in
your
pocket."
There were sunflower
seeds. Yeah, so at least where you fall, there will be flowers that grow.
Yeah. Right.
God, it was like such a burn.
It was a burn. Yeah. When you die here, the seeds will grow.
Yeah.
Okay. That means that Ukrainians rarely smile in public and in fact would find it rude if you smiled at them. That one is science.
Now, weird.
It's not because they're cold. They're a very friendly people. It is purely cultural. When you smile at them, they think you're making fun of them and they think it's disrespectful. And so they don't smile at you because to them that's an expression of respect. Unless, of course, you're very familiar. So that would be more of in an intimate setting, but not like in a public setting.
Right. Like not just a random person you're passing by on the street.
Yes. You would never smile at somebody, randomly. You would never. Yeah.
Whereas here, if you don't smile, people are like, what?
Yeah, and there's a
like, why aren't you being nice?
There's a north-south on the East Coast anyway. There's a north-south cultural spectrum in the United States. The farther south you go, the more people smile. And if you don't smile, it's weird. Whereas if you get close to like New York and I think probably New York is the peak at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Smiling is not that common, again, in like walking on the street among New Yorkers.
When I was 20 years old, Steve, I moved from Texas to New York and nobody warned me of that.
Yeah, right. So you experienced it. Yeah.
Pretty jarring. Yeah.
Right.
Pretty jarring.
Yeah. There's also like there are lots of articles about this. Some talk about the fact that like if you're going to visit someplace, you do want to become aware of some of their cultural specifics. Like, for example, Ukrainians aren't huggers either, so like don't go in for the hug for a Ukrainian. They will do the cheek kiss, but only female to female or female to male, almost never male to male.
Okay, so that's common. That's kind of the same here. We don't do it that often, but that would be sort of what was more appropriate.
So for a guy to guy, you're going to go for the handshake at most. Anyway, I vetted that with multiple, I'm not an expert, but I vetted it as much as I could with multiple reputable sources. They all tell the same kind of story about why that's cultural in Ukraine, but it doesn't mean that they're not friendly. It just is like, it's a respect thing. It's just how they interpret it. That means that the world's deepest metro station is in Kyiv, Arsenalna station at 105.5 meters deep. That is very, very deep underground.
Wow.
And it's interesting because a lot of they're using the metro stations as bomb shelters.
Why so deep though, Steve? Do you know?
I couldn't find like a engineering reason why it was deep. It's probably just the geography.
Yeah, gotta be.
So there's something about historical buildings. Maybe they're just trying to keep away from them. But I didn't find a concrete. This is why it's so deep. It's just, but factors are mentioned, but it's not clear exactly what is like the specific reason. Maybe somebody who knows more about that than I could have found in the time I had to do the research. But yeah, it's pretty deep. Yeah, just I know it's mostly trivia, guys. This is just kind of a fun one just to talk about Ukraine since it was talked about at the top of the show.
Yeah. And you swept us.
And I swept you.
Oh boy!
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
And the quote this week comes from listener Darren in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He is offering us a quote from an educational educational YouTuber named CGP Gray, G-R-E-Y.
Oh, I love CGP Gray.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, he's the best.
Found out upon the recommendation.
Oh, you're going to be obsessed. You're going to like go down
the list. Oh, yeah, I already started. But here's the quote. Keep your identity separate from your opinions. Your opinions are objects in a box you carry with you and should be easily replaceable if it turns out they're no good. If you think that the opinions in the box are who you are, then you'll cling to them despite any evidence to the contrary. Bottom line, if you want to always be right, you need to always be prepared to change your mind. That is very good advice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Keep your ideas in a box.
And if you go to his YouTube, yeah, that's, you know, it's in the box. If you go to his YouTube page, you'll see cool videos that he makes that he has made there, including ones titled "How to Be a Pirate," right, Bob? And "Hexagons Are the Bestagons." I like that one, and I agree. Hexagons are the bomb.
You like the old Hex maps.
Oh gosh, the Hex maps. Remember? Oh my god, don't get me started. Hex versus squares.
Oh,
hexes
god,
all the way.
We have to have this question. I mean, Evan, we have to have this discussion because I don't agree,
Friday,
my
yeah.
friend.
Oh no, we will have that discussion, Jay.
Unless
oh my
we
gosh,
have it
we
now?
Totally. We,
no.
Save it for the Friday show.
Or maybe we'll do that as a throwdown during one of the
interesting.
Hex maps versus square maps. Go.
Please, I want hexes.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Yes.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
We'll see everybody at the Friday live stream. Don't forget, we do a 1.5 hour live streaming show every Friday starting at 5 Eastern time. So join us for that. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.